Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, nearly 6,000 USDA workers fired by Trump are ordered back to work for now. An independent federal board ordered USDA to temporarily reinstate close to 6,000 employees fired since February 13th for just 45 days, finding reasonable grounds to believe the agency acted illegally in terminating them. We'll hear from some USDA workers in New York who were impacted by the firing and are awaiting word about returning to work. Wayne County seedling sale is underway, featuring a variety of native trees, shrubs, and ornamentals, which are beneficial for wildlife. Ulster County has a new poet laureate. We'll meet him. And the Met Opera is back at SUNY Sullivan this Saturday with the first ever Met Live and HD transmission of Beethoven's Fidelio. It's coming up, but first the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks opened lower this morning as President Trump poured more alcohol on the flames of the trade war. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 170 points in early trading.
In a social media post, President Trump threatened to impose a 200% tariff on European wines and spirits. The move comes after the European Union said as of April 1st, it will tax Kentucky bourbon and other American products in retaliation for Trump's own steel and aluminum tariffs. The president, who's a teetotaler himself, insists the trade battle will be good for domestic winemakers. In another social media post, Trump claimed the price of eggs has come down since he took office. In fact, new inflation data out this week shows egg prices jumped more than 10% in February. Wholesale inflation cooled a little bit last month. Wholesale prices are up 3.2% over the last year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration has withdrawn its nomination for the next head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, according to a Senate panel. Today's hearing for former Florida Congressman Dr. David Weldon has been canceled. Weldon was expected to face scrutiny on his position on vaccines. A person familiar with the withdrawal, but not authorized to discuss it, told NPR that it was clear he did not have the votes in the Senate. Today is the deadline set by the Trump administration for federal agencies to submit plans for layoffs. NPR Stephen Fowler reports it's part of the president's effort to downsize government.
Phase one of the agency RIF and reorganization plan asks agencies to list jobs and obligations that are essential and encourages them to cut just about everything else. Some, like the Department of Education, have already announced their intention to fire large numbers of employees through reductions in force that will take effect in a few months. Phase two plans, due mid-April, asks agencies to ID more ways to cut costs, like moving offices out of Washington, D.C., and axing regulations. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Atlanta.
It's going to be really hot in southern Texas over the next couple of days. Weather forecasters say it will probably hit 90 degrees in San Antonio today before it cools off for the weekend. Iran has rejected President Trump's offer to hold new talks over a nuclear deal, saying the U.S. wouldn't honor any new arrangement. NPR's Aya Batrawi reports they say that's because Trump overturned a different nuclear deal with Iran in his last administration.
Since Trump scuttled the nuclear deal in 2018, Iran has been increasing its stockpile of enriched uranium, according to UN inspectors. But also, you know, the U.S. and Israel, which has hit nuclear targets in Iran before, they're not the only countries involved here. The U.K., France, and Germany have continued talks with Iran about its nuclear program. And tomorrow, China, Russia, and Iran are meeting in Beijing to discuss Iran's nuclear program and the sanctions that are crippling its economy.
NPR's Aya Batrawi reporting. This is NPR. Senate Democratic leaders say they aren't going to support a Republican-drafted government spending bill. This boosts the chance of a partial federal government shutdown late tomorrow night. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer wants to push off that deadline for a month for bipartisan talks on spending. A new report from conservation groups finds that bird populations in nearly every habitat in the U.S. are declining. NPR's Jonathan Lambert explains roughly a third of all species are at high or moderate levels of conservation concern.
In 2019, a comprehensive study reported that North America had lost 3 billion birds in 50 years. Now, a follow-up report analyzing trends in over 240 species finds that these losses are continuing. Grassland and desert birds are declining fastest as habitat loss, drought, and invasive species shrink populations. Ducks had been a bright spot in past reports, but loss of wetland habitats have led to duck declines in the Great Plains. Species targeted by conservation efforts, like the American oyster catcher, saw improvement, highlighting the power of environmental policy. But recent actions by the Trump administration, including weakening protections for migratory birds, could slow such efforts. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
The Alaska Volcano Observatory says there are more gas emissions coming from Mount Spur. That volcano is about 80 miles west of Alaska's biggest city, Anchorage. Researchers say the volcano could erupt in the next few weeks or months. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. The Department of Government Efficiency has taken a sledgehammer to the federal government's operations in an effort to cut spending under the orders of billionaire Elon Musk. That effort has led to the firing of thousands of federal employees with little or no warning, including nearly 6,000 employees of the United States Department of Agriculture. But the USDA said yesterday it would comply with a Wednesday deadline issued by a federal board to temporarily reinstate its fired probationary employees, according to an agency statement. By Wednesday afternoon, official word of the reinstatement still had not reached fired employees, who remain wary of what's ahead. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Southern Adirondack Bureau Chief Aaron Shella Levine spoke with three USDA employees caught up in the turmoil.
Elise Soto, Jackie Adler, and Kate Westcott were all fired on February 14th.
Yep, Valentine's Day massacre. They let go like 4,000 people within 20 hours.
Each received nearly identical termination letters that read, in part, quote, "The agency finds, based on your performance, that you have not demonstrated that your further employment at the agency would be in the public interest," end quote. Westcott and Soto had joined the food distribution branch of the Northeast Regional Office's Food Nutrition Services in December, working remotely. Westcott says it came out of nowhere.
The email was very rude and, you know, said, you know, based on your performance, you're not good for the American people. Your job shouldn't be continued, which I thought was crazy because I had only worked there for a couple months and I hadn't had a performance review yet. So and my boss, you know, congratulated both Lisa and I on our progress, felt like we were progressing through our training very well.
Their branch had three employees cut out of seven. They coordinate federal grants and help seven states, including New York, Vermont, Massachusetts, and Connecticut, and the Virgin Islands, distribute food.
The food will not get to the people who need it. Because that's the biggest issue that I think is going to happen. We, Elise and I, dealt with distributing local domestic food product to these programs. And so anytime there was a delivery issue or even just ordering the food to get to the schools and the elderly assistance program and to the food banks, like we were handling those deliveries and distributions. And so I'm worried that the food is not going to get to where it needs to go and that people are going to go hungry.
Soto says a job at USDA was something she spent years building up to. The whirlwind of losing it has been a shock to the system, putting her and her child at risk of needing the programs she was helping to coordinate.
So mid-December we got hired, and then mid-February we were fired. Before that, I worked for New York State Office of General Services. I administered the Emergency Food Assistance Program there for New York State for 2 years. And it's very near and dear to my heart. The mission is to support the emergency food network. Before that, I have a background in being a child from food insecurity. So it kind of just brought me full circle. I was able to get out of a tight spot when I was younger, and I moved up, went to college. I went to culinary school, actually. So food has very much been a part of my life. And from the state to the federal government, and now back again to food assistance, needing food assistance.
As federal employees share their stories, many are doing so anonymously. But Soto says it's important to put names and faces to the statistics.
I think it's to show the other person that you can speak up, your voice matters, your story matters, and it just brings humanity to it. I'm a single mother, and this has caused a detriment to my household. But not only that, I want other people to know that you can be brave enough and speak up and use your voice because you matter, right? We're all American citizens here. We matter. Our voice matters. And with the support of the unions, I think sharing our names and sharing our stories also shows them that we're all in this together.
Westcott says one of the most disheartening parts of the past month has been seeing an increase in rhetoric online that paints federal employees as lazy or just looking for a paycheck. They believe in the missions of their branches and want to make sure the most vulnerable citizens in their region can survive.
My manager was working, honestly, like 15 hours a day, not getting reimbursed for it, not getting paid for it, but because she cared about the program and wanted people to be able to be fed. And even when we got terminated at 9 o'clock in the morning, I stayed until 5:30. Like, I wanted to make sure that everything was still good to go until the last possible second that I could, until I got kicked off my computer. Like, it, you know, I could be making more money somewhere else. That's not why I'm doing it. I want to help people.
Adler had been at the Food and Nutrition Services branch working on community nutrition programs for 7 weeks before she was laid off. She says it's not like there was a lot of bloat to begin with in the regional office.
See, Nero itself, the Northeast Regional Office, should be staffed at about 120. We were staffed before we were fired at 100. Mm-hmm. Now they are staffed at 84 out of 120. So please explain to me how that's efficient when people are not going to be able to get the work done that needs to get done in the time that it needs to be done so that people can get the services they need on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Prior to her brief stint with USDA, Adler had worked in public schools for a decade. She was driven to join the USDA after seeing the importance of free, quality meals at schools.
I never had a backup plan because, as we've all said, like, this is the culmination. Like, you get to this place and you're like, cool, I've worked my butt off, I've done all these things, this is where I retire from. And that always was the concept.
Adler was assigned to coordinate a novel summer EBT program for families who rely on school lunches to feed their kids year-round. A program she says will now go understaffed, possibly resulting in children going unnecessarily hungry. She adds there's irony in DOGE's goal of increasing efficiency by cutting skilled workers with years of program experience.
We're, not to be funny, like the best of the best. I mean, we're people who know these programs. I've worked in schools. You guys have done the jobs you've done. I mean, you know your programs. And we take that knowledge and expertise so that we can help state agencies. And the irony of government efficiency is if they want efficiency, we're the people, because we know how to look at state agencies and other programs and say, hey, you're not doing this right. You need to spend your money this way. Without us and without people at the top like that, there's no guidance for state agencies and other people.
All three women are probationary employees and had no plan B. They expected to stay longer than 2 months after working so long to join the USDA. As reported by NPR, USDA is set to temporarily reinstate most of the employees fired thus far for 45 days, while an investigation into their terminations continue. Soto says she'd return if given the chance, even if only temporarily.
Yes, because of the mission. It's very important to me, and I said I would absolutely go back. Do I trust my job to be secure, even though I'm supposed to be a union contracted employee? No, not at all.
I think we all need backup plans.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it's time to look at backup plans, because you can't trust the government.
Soto says as of Wednesday, they have not heard from USDA about being reinstated. Reporting for the Southern Adirondack Bureau on the campus of Skidmore College, I'm Aaron Schello-Levine for WAMC News.
Thanks to the New York Public News Network for that report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Wayne County's annual seedling sale. We'll learn more after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
When Dresden was bombed in 1945, thousands of ancient manuscripts were ruined, totally illegible, until one scholar discovered a new way to read them.
By taking separate photographs in multiple wavelengths, we can reveal things that the naked eye can't see.
Found in Translation. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we've got the beloved video star, recipe developer, and best-selling cookbook author, Sola El Whaley. Spend the hour with her talking about her inspirations, and we answer your cooking questions. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Wayne Conservation District is now accepting orders for its annual seedling sale, with orders due by April 1st. The sale offers a variety of native trees, shrubs, and ornamentals, many of which are beneficial for wildlife. Trevor Tokudlowski, forest specialist from the Wayne Conservation District, is back to tell us more about the Conservation District's seedling sale. Trevor, welcome back. Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
The seedling sale is a popular event. What can you tell us about the history of this sale and the importance to the community?
Well, it's been going on a very long time now, much longer than I've been at the Conservation District. It's probably one of our oldest events that's still ongoing. And we've put out thousands and thousands and thousands of seedlings throughout Wayne County and the surrounding area. And one of the nice things about it is that it's, of course, it's not exclusive to Wayne County. I mean, of course, you know, we do tend to operate within our borders, but this isn't something that's exclusive to our residents. And we're directly responsible for distributing seedlings to all parts of Northeast PA and the surrounding area. So it's pretty significant, not only for residents, but of course for the ecosystem too.
So you're welcoming folks on both sides of the river to come and take part.
Absolutely, by all means.
And so this year's sale has a variety of native trees and shrubs and ornamentals, as I mentioned. What are some of the key offerings, and why were these particular plants chosen?
Yeah, so we have, as usual, we do have some of our fruit trees and our berries. We tend to switch those up a little bit every year. But the things that are our main options are always going to be our native trees and shrubs. We do have one that's non-native, and I'll get to that in a second. But right now, the options are black cherry, shagbark hickory, red osier dogwood, tulip poplar, and the non-native option is Norway spruce. So the reason why these species were selected, obviously each of them have their own unique attributes, but we try to offer a pretty broad selection for trees that can be used both in an ornamental sense, a wildlife sense, and possibly even a timber sense. And if you're really lucky, you might be able to get a species like shagbark hickory that might be kind of ideal for all of those things. Our only non-native option is Norway spruce. The only reason why we do that, we do try to encourage native species first and foremost, but we do offer this one simply because a lot of our native conifer species aren't doing incredibly well at the moment. And this is one species that's been recorded by a few different agencies as being a good surrogate species for our native conifers that's much more hardy.
Talk a little bit about these trees, black cherry, shagbark hickory, and even the non-native Norway spruce. How do they contribute to the local ecosystems?
Sure, yeah. So if we want to go through each one kind of line by line, black cherry, a lot of people are probably more familiar with it in a timber sense, but it's a great wildlife tree, very fast growing. They're probably one of the most unique trees in our forest as well. A lot of times people describe their bark as being like burnt potato chips that has that flaky, dark coloration. But they're great for wildlife because, as the name suggests, I mean, they do produce cherries, usually about on an annual basis. Some crop years are better than others, but birds can't get enough of them, turkeys as well. Shagbark hickory, very, very similar. One of the major differences between these species is hickory species tend to be a little bit more slow growing. Great timber species, and on top of that, of course, they do drop hickory nuts, some of the largest out of all of our native hickory species. The two that kind of differ a little bit more from the others, tulip poplar, that swings a little bit in a different direction where it's not as great for some of our larger wildlife species, but it's great for insects. It's an awesome pollinator tree, and it grows incredibly fast. And some people describe it as being the largest tree species east of the Mississippi River. And then lastly, the shrub species that we offer is red osier dogwood. It's a versatile species, very, very pretty in the winter. It gets bright red stems. And on top of that, it's good for stream bank stabilization. So you can kind of use it in wet areas. And the nice thing is it doesn't get very tall. So if you live along a river or stream and you kind of want to add to the aesthetic beauty without taking away from the view, it's a great species for that. And that's one that's great for both wildlife and pollinators. And then, of course, lastly, the Norway spruce. You got to have a little bit of green in the winter landscape. So we try to offer them as a hardy species that's good not only for birds, but a variety of other species through the because it provides thermal cover.
And it's not just trees that are beneficial to wildlife. Some flowers beneficial as well, including the black-eyed Susan. Talk about how that particular flower benefits wildlife.
Yeah, absolutely. So black-eyed Susan and the purple coneflower, both native varieties. The good thing about these guys is that deer don't necessarily like to eat them. I know that you'll probably, results may vary with them a little bit. I truly don't believe that there's any plants that are truly deer resistant. But the nice thing about these guys is that it's another addition for our pollinators. You know, we really want to make sure that we're, you know, we're providing opportunities for those guys to gather nectar. And just as kind of a general, you know, ecosystem web, all of these little players are they play a monumental role. So we offer those as well. And then in addition to the some of our other smaller options like the black raspberry, where similar thing, great for the pollinators, and of course the raspberries are good for us and the wildlife on top.
And talk a little bit more about why it's critical for people to consider planting native species and how the sale of these helps promote environmental conservation locally.
Yeah, absolutely. So the reason why we encourage native species is because our forests, and you could kind of argue this in different senses, but I would say that our forests are in a bit of a state of distress. We have a lot of foreign actors in our forests in the sense of both insects, fungal pathogens, and other non-native species that were not exactly that aren't exactly supposed to be here. The reason why we encourage natives as a primary thing is simply because a lot of the non-native actors actively displace our native species. The reason why you know might be thinking, well, you know, what's the big deal about that? Well, the entirety of the ecosystem hinges on these organisms that have interacted with each other for millennia. It's a kind of a checks and balance system, and when you start introducing these foreign actors that might not exactly play well with our native species, it's kind of a domino effect. So we want to try to keep our plants native. It's beneficial to not only the people keeping the environment clean, but the organisms that interact with them on top of it. It's critical.
Now, these are seedlings. You're not going to get a giant cherry tree to plant. So when you come to pick things up, what advice do you have for folks on the care of these new seedlings and plants once they're coming by to pick them up?
Yeah. So you're absolutely right. So these come as bare root seedlings, but this year we're doing something a little bit different. Rather than doing the bagging ourselves, these are coming from the nursery directly with moist packaging. So they should keep a little bit longer, but you're absolutely right. These are bare root seedlings. My advice would be if you can't plant them immediately, keep them in a cool, a moist environment so that they remain in a state of dormancy, because that's kind of the one of the disadvantages about bare root seedlings is that, you know, you can only plant them once a year when they're in that state. But if you can, I would recommend plant them as quickly as reasonably possible. And then on top of that, make sure that you're following up on watering your seedlings. There's a lot of sources, and I've just noticed this in my own personal observations, that watering is probably the most critical act when it comes to the survival of your seedling. And if possible, if you decide to purchase from us and plant your seedlings, make sure you keep them protected from the deer as well, at least until they get about 5 feet tall, and then they should be well above the browse line so that they should be relatively smooth sailing from that point.
Always have to be on watch out for the deer. Bluebird nesting boxes, a new addition this year. What role do bluebirds play in the local environment, and why are these nesting boxes so important?
Yeah, well, so exactly. I mean, when it comes to really any of our bird species, you know, they're going to help keep insect populations in check. They're going to be, I mean, and I guess it depends on the sense that you're talking about it, but birds are also largely responsible for distributing seeds. Sometimes if you're talking about invasives, that might not exactly be ideal. Bluebirds, I of course, every single bird fills their own particular niche, but like any other species that are of that size, they're going to play a critical role in you know, maintaining insect populations, making sure that seeds are distributed, and of course, filling their respective niche, which might come with its own respective benefits. But with the bluebird houses, it's going to help, it's going to help provide a space for them to help, you know, rear their young and kind of continue their life cycle and help maintain those populations in a way that's, you know, we're giving them a little bit of a helping hand by doing that.
Okay, so orders are due by April 1st for the seedling sale. Pickup is later in the month. Let's remind folks the process for placing an order and how can residents ensure they get what they want before the deadline?
Yeah, so the good thing is a lot of times we are actually able to amend our orders from the nursery. So it's very rare that we do run out of certain things. Of course, that is always a possibility, but we do try to stay on top of it and maintain orders as they come in. The easiest thing to do is just to send us a flyer with the check in the mail. All of that information can be found at our website under the forestry section at wayneconservation.com. If you're getting a little bit close to the deadline, we do tend to honor orders that were mailed prior to the actual due date. But if you're ever worried about something not reaching us, you could just write out a check and stop in and see us because we're here Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 4:30.
All right, Trevor Todolowski from the Wayne Conservation District, a forest specialist, talking to us about the Conservation District's seedling sale. Again, the deadline is April 1st. Trevor, thanks so much, and I'm sure we'll have you back this spring.
Awesome. Great. Thank you for having me.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll meet the new Ulster County Poet Laureate. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
For the next jazz night in America, Sarah Hanahan, one of the rising stars of the alto saxophone.
My playing and my style, it would be a mix of all these people I've taken things from, including Bird and Jackie McLean, John Coltrane, and then taking my own take on it.
That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Join me Sunday at 8 here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Mike Jerkovic is Ulster County's new 2025 Poet Laureate. He was appointed by County Executive Jen Metzger. Jerkovic, a published poet and music critic, succeeded Kate Himes of New Paltz, the county's first resident to hold this honorary title, created in 2023. As part of his goals for the role, he says he expects to reach more people in his community through artistic expression and poetry. Radio Catskill's Miguel Santiago Colon spoke to Jerkovic about his reaction to the news.
Considering all the wonderful writers of all styles and genres and whatever the heck you want to say that populate the Hudson Valley and most importantly, Ulster County, it is really it's a privilege to do this, to be in this position. And I hope to make all those people's voices amplified somehow too.
Were you surprised or was this something that was negotiated beforehand? Like, what was your impression upon first hearing the news?
I was happy. I wasn't expecting it, to be honest. I mean, I've been working, let's say the poetry circuit for about 30 years here in the Hudson Valley. And it's a nice recognition. Maybe somewhere in the back of my head, it was like, wow, it's got to be coming someday. It's got to be someday. But it wasn't forefront in my mind, though.
As a poet laureate, what do you do? What are the tasks that go in hand with that distinction and that new appointment?
Well, the biggest task really is just making folks, and I think most people do, but they take it for granted. Poetry is a part of our life no matter what. I mean, we think, oh, April is the big poetry month and that's when we have to pay attention to it. But, you know, you go to get a card for, you know, your significant other or you're reading from some holy text or, and it's poetry and it's there every day. And it's to recognize it just in April, or to recognize it because you got a poetry book for your birthday or something. It's here all the it's here with us 24/7.
Could you tell me a bit about yourself? You know, how like how do you get into poetry? When did you start reading poems? Was it something that, you know, you started doing early in your life?
I started writing when I was about I was a pretty good student in grade school growing up in the Bronx. And my parents would, for a good report card, my parents would monster models, Frankenstein, Dracula, the Wolfman, and the superhero models, you know, Superman, Batman, Spider-Man. And they would get them for me. And I would put, and I had a whole collection of these things. And after a while, somewhere maybe around sixth, seventh grade, I started writing stories for each one. And then eventually you trip into Bob Dylan, and you trip into Kerouac, and you trip into Joni Mitchell. And it's like, oh, wait, maybe it doesn't have to be stories. Maybe it can be something shorter with sharper images. And I fell into doing that. I mean, I owe the writing of poetry and the pursuit of it to Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, all those names that I know you've heard a million times. Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, Kenneth Patchen. And when I started taking creative writing in high school and in college, they're like, hey, you know, you've got something here. Keep going at it. And that's what pretty much what I've done. And then I was fortunate enough, somewhere in my 20s, I think mid-20s, I fell in with a bunch of musicians in Westchester County. And they liked how I put words together, so I was writing songs with them, and then it just branched out from there.
And how do you start exploring, not only just reading poetry, how do you start exploring just writing in general and then moving on to poetry from that specific age to, you know, now?
To now?
Yeah. I know it's I know it's like a broad question, but bear with me here, because I'm very interested in hearing that.
Like the dead said, it's a long, strange trip. And, it really is. You get into a groove, really, you know, and a lot of my stuff is very rhythmical. When I read, I try to be as rhythmical as possible so that it's not just, just like that. I can't take that. So I always look for the rhythm in things, and the music was very helpful for that. So as I expanded from reading, from basically just reading, to listening to, you know, rock and roll, the folk singers, jazz, it just opened up more and more, and it allowed the language to open up more. Like, you know, you can actually find different words. You know, you want to say, that's what they make thesaurus is for, and you find, you know, you want to use a word, let's say warm or something, okay? And you say to yourself, oh, God, how many times am I going to use warm? Or is warm going to be used? And you go look for new words. And those new words create new rhythms. And you go with that rhythm. And maybe you come upon another word that's like, I've used that 7 times in the last 2 days. I don't want to use that anymore. You look up for a different word, and that forms a whole nother rhythm. And you just chug along that way. It works for me anyway.
I know you work with other mediums like music, for example. Could you share with us, could you tell me about other ways you work inside your community, with poetry and music?
Oh, yeah. Well, I write on a regular basis with a wonderful musician here in the New Paltz area, John Martucci. He's a very humble guy, so he's going to shy away from me even mentioning this. But we've written well over 100 songs or so. And some of them are good, and some of them you wouldn't want to hear. You know, and I was writing with other folks, like I said, in Westchester when I first started. Excuse me. In 1991... I was part of a duo called New Nervous Voice, and we had a couple of songs on college radio throughout the Northeast. We had one called Psycho Squid. We had one called God's VCR and Egoectomy. And we actually had a little distribution deal with a small independent label in Manhattan. And we were just about to do our second album, which was going to be called Lust and Judgment. And financial situations got in the way, especially for my partner. So he had to break away for a while. And I got married, and we and things just the music. And we to this day, like I said, I still write with John. But we haven't done one in about a year and a half, but we were doing almost on a, I'd say, quarterly basis. We were doing the thing called Jazzoetry, which is the poetry and a jazz quartet. And it's, we've got one of the best jazz quartets you can imagine, with Bobby Kopeck on bass and Eric Person on sax and Dean Sharp on drums and the wonderful Joe Tranchina on keyboards. And when they join us, we get like six or seven poets, either from this area or New York, or if they want to come down from Albany, and we let it rip. It's the some of the stuff is up on YouTube. You can see it, and we let it rip and have some fun. So the music's always incorporated in poetry, one way, shape, form, or another. Like I was talking about the rhythms before. You know, even when people might get locked into like a monotone, there's still some kind of faint rhythm there. There's still some kind of musicality to it, even if it is a bit droney. It's, you know, it still is.
No, I completely agree. I work with, for example, audio and podcast, and you'd be surprised just how much musicality goes into it. Sometimes you're listening to absolutely. A person talk, and you're like, they fall into a certain rhythm that you want to arrange just so it's easier to the ear. So I, no surprise there that, you know, music and poetry go well together. You mentioned, that you were raised in the Bronx, and I read mm-hmm. that, you know, for the past 30 years, you've been, you know, living in Ulster County.
Yep.
Normally it's the other way around. I feel that normally you go from like a rural to like an urban place, but I wanted to ask you too, like, how is the place around you, the place that you're living in now, in this part of your life? I don't want to say affected your poetry, maybe influence your poetry or inspire you, on certain types of work. I know that your surroundings normally influence any person or, in their work. How did mm-hmm. it go with you?
Well, my wife has established a beautiful home around us, and so God bless her for that. But if I was to try and equate these beautiful surroundings to some of the really odd stuff that I write, she'd probably start yelling at me, so I won't do that. I think it's mostly a matter of the times we live in. I mean, it's a beautiful area here. This can't go wrong here. So some of that does come through, especially in the haikus more than anything else. But I think I'm more a reflection. My work is more a reflection of the times that we find ourselves in, especially now. Yeah, I think it's more the times than my immediate surroundings. Yeah.
You know, we had mentioned before that, you know, this new appointment comes with a few responsibilities. Could you walk us through again, you know, what those responsibilities will do and what do you plan on doing for the next year? And what goals do you have in mind for your tenure?
Well, there are two main goals that I would like to establish. And I've already spoken with Amberlee from the county exec's office about it. And we're going to talk about it a little deeper. As I mentioned earlier in the interview, there were some great writers that have passed through this area. Some of them are gone now, and I would like to try and establish a poet laureate in memoriam. So I don't know if that just becomes an established post that each successive laureate adds to. I don't know if that's just a proclamation. I don't know how that works in the legal term, but I would really like to work and try and establish that. And I also would like to try one of the real main things that I would like to, and we're starting to toss the idea around now, is I would like to establish a Hudson Valley poetry archive, if not an actual physical space. Okay. Because the organization that I've been with for 26 years now, Calling All Poets, we have recordings at audio, digital, photography, books that basically reflect everything from, let's go back to 1991 to today. And the world has been through a lot of changes since then. And the folks here in the Hudson Valley and those that have joined us from all over the region and since Zoom all over the world, they have something to say about those times. And it's the oral story of our times. And I would like to get that established somehow here in the Hudson Valley, because I think it's important culturally, it's important historically, it's important educationally. Again, if we could find some way to make a physical base out of it, maybe it even becomes a point of tourism, a destination spot. I have no idea. But it is an idea that I would like to really discuss further. Those would be the two main goals. As far as what I'm going to do for the next year, Artsman Hudson has really pretty much left it up to me. So I'm going to establish a few readings. We're going to be doing a reading in June 1st at the Rosendale Theater. With four of the most recent poet laureates from the area. And we're going to do a question and answer and a reading there. I've spoken to the New Paltz Library, the Milton Library. Maybe I can reach out to folks there in Jeffersonville and set up a reading of some kind. I hope to get in touch with the LGBTQ Community Center in Kingston and do more themed trans type of reading, just so that everybody feels that they have a voice. And everybody feels that that voice is being heard. And I think now more than ever, that's really important.
You know, I think exposing the youth to great works of poetry can work really well. Do you plan on doing something related to the youth, to teaching poetry to just maybe younger audiences or children?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, we're always trying to reach younger audiences, especially as a lot of the folks who run Calling All Poets are getting up there in ages, they may say. I remember a dear friend of ours who was head of creative writing at SUNY New Paltz, and she always advocated and supported our organization. And I was in her office one time, and I was like, we got to get the students out to the readings. And she was like, Mike, I can't even promise they're going to get to class, you know? So, I mean, it's an uphill battle. You do occasionally get a few here and a few young folks here and a few young folks there. That's why I'm talking to the libraries. Hopefully we can get, maybe we'll do something with students. I know I'm going to be reading at SUNY New Paltz sometime in the fall, and I'm also going to be doing something for a Poetry Out Loud event up at SUNY Ulster, but I'm not sure when that is. So I hope to reach the younger folks. Yeah, that would be special. Yeah, absolutely.
What do you look most forward to for the next year?
Meeting people. I'm a very sociable kind of guy. So meeting people is part of who I am. So, I'm going to be setting up readings and organizing readings and events and stuff like that. Will a lot of the usual suspects be there? More than likely. So, but you're catching up with people. You're talking to, hey, man, I didn't see you 2 weeks. What's going on? How's the family? So it's always... it's a social give and take. It always has been. Whether we're telling stories through the poems or we're spreading the news through the poems or whatever the case might be, it's always been a social interaction. If you just read poetry, you can get locked into a certain mindset. But if you're actually reading it, speaking it, and having it spoken back to you, I think there's that social interplay that you just don't get sitting in a room and reading it. So I enjoy the social interplay more than anything else.
I'm glad. Mike, before we finish, do you have something else do you want our audience to know about?
Yeah, I would like them to know that don't be afraid of poetry. It's not a bad thing. Like I said earlier, it's there all the time. It's around you all the time. And if you can possibly, calling all poets is Zoom only event. It's every first Friday and third Thursday. It's a $3 donation through a tip jar or PayPal. And if you can join us, please do, because the voices are from all over now. I mean, we have in February, we had a poet from Ireland join, two folks from Brooklyn and here in the Hudson Valley. This month in March, we're going to have a gentleman from Malaysia and two folks who teach right here at SUNY New Paltz. So we're mixing it all up and finding out that we're not as separated and we're not as different as our leaders would have us believe.
Mike Durkovic, once again, congratulations on the appointment. Thank you so much for being with us here at Radio Catskill. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it too, man. Thank you, and come on out when you can.
Liberty, I'm Miguel Santiago Colón for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the Met in HD returns to SUNY Sullivan on Saturday. We'll get a preview after this. This is Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, hints on how to tackle weeknight dinners from Melissa Clark and Emily Weinstein of the New York Times. We'll also hear from writer Lori Wolliver. Her new memoir, Care and Feeding, is about the highs and lows of working in the restaurant industry, including the many years she spent working with the late Anthony Bourdain. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill brings the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania to life. We cover local stories, alert you to important information, and share cultural programming to keep local traditions alive. Visit protectmypublicmedia.org and safeguard public media's future.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Metropolitan Opera's award-winning series of high-definition cinema simulcasts have been playing at SUNY Sullivan's Selig Theater since December, and the latest live opera performance via satellite from the Metropolitan Opera in New York to SUNY Sullivan Direct occurs Saturday with Beethoven's Fidelio. Dan Rigney from SUNY Sullivan and Jamie Hargrove, board member of the SUNY Sullivan Foundation, are joining us now with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
And what I did not indicate to the listener, Jamie, is that you're a former opera singer.
Correct.
So you can tell me, who doesn't know anything about opera, tell us a little bit more about the significance of Beethoven's Fidelio in the world of opera.
So Fidelio is Beethoven's only opera and is a masterpiece. He's known for his symphonies and the Messiahs and the Missa Solemnis and the Ninth Symphony, but Fidelio is his masterpiece.
And the cast for this production is, what I'm told, very remarkable singers. Talk a little bit about some of these cast members, including Lise Davidson.
Yes, the Norwegian soprano. But also it's important to talk about the conductor, Susanna Malki. She's a quite remarkable conductor. But we have Young Fung, and we have Magnus Dietrich opening for the season. And we have the fantastic René Pop, the bass, the German bass, René Pop.
What's your perspective on the role of SUNY Sullivan in making these world-class performances available to the public as a board member of SUNY Sullivan's Foundation that's helping bring these to folks, and especially for folks who may not typically attend an opera performance?
Well, I think the initiative of the Met is to popularize opera and bring back the viability of people watching opera. Those are broadcast simultaneously, so it's almost like being there. It's affordable, and I think that it's a time where opera has some viability here in Sullivan County.
Dan, I mentioned that these have been playing since December. How have you seen folks interacting with these satellite performances at SUNY Sullivan? And how's it sort of changed their interaction with the arts?
Well, first of all, thanks again to WGFF for being a media sponsor here and really promoting this. There was you know, previous to this run, a hardcore group of people who really enjoyed these opera screenings. And one of the beauties of what happened in December and January is they came back. They came back in full. They were overjoyed with it. And a number of them actually are Met Opera, like, season ticket holders. They go down, they see it live, and then they come back and they see it in the C-League Theater, because the views you get at these performances are unbelievable. There's no, you'd never see everything that you can see on screen that you would see in the seat itself. So it's a different kind of experience. I have had people who haven't been to the opera before who came back and loved it and saw that it was something that they could actually understand. They're like, oh, if I can go and see Pixar, I can go and see this.
Yeah. What do you think, you know, this is being, like I said, this is coming direct from New York's Metropolitan Opera to SUNY Sullivan, but also it's beamed all over the world, like simultaneously. Correct. This Correct. Is a whole series of cinema simulcasts across the world. What do you think that does to unite people from different cultures and communities and locations, knowing that they're experiencing this with a lot of other people at the same time?
Well, I think that the art in general, it's a global experience, you know, not just opera, but we talk about the impact of, like, visual arts. And that I think that opera combines both music and visual arts. And bringing this to a global community, it's really, like, very strong, very, very powerful.
Does this opera in particular, Fidelio, and being Beethoven's only opera, does that help bridge that sort of gap between people who may not understand opera that much or people who love opera? Is there something more accessible about this? And what should people look for in this performance?
What's very specific about this opera is that it parallels with Beethoven's real life. Beethoven was dealing with his deafness. He's becoming increasingly more and more deaf. And Florestan, the main character that's in prison, he runs a parallel with his life. So it's a very, very deep significance there.
There's some accessibility there for people. Absolutely. Understanding the biographical nature of him as well. Do you guys expect that the people will continue to be able to experience the Met in HD moving forward past this season?
Absolutely. We've already been given dates from the Metropolitan Opera. We saw this season as being a rebuild, a reboot for it, and it's starting to demonstrate that, yes, the audience is there. They want to come. The ticket price is really affordable, and we have a special ticket price even for youth, for seniors, and so forth. They go to the website, and they can at sunysullivan.edu and learn more about it, and it's right here. Not everyone can get in the car and drive 2.5 hours and pay New York City parking prices and go to a Met Opera performance. You're going to spend hundreds of dollars to get that done. Here, it's far less than that, and you have the experience of having it right here in your backyard.
I think it's on the edge of that congestion pricing zone, too. That's another benefit. Plus, you can go home and go to bed. What does it mean for both of you personally, just having this prestigious cultural event in the area? Jamie, we've known each other for many years. I've been here for many years. Being part of this and bringing something like this to the area, what does that mean for you personally?
Well, I mean, it's opera was my first passion, and I studied for many years, and being able to see this as vernacular here in Sullivan County, it's quite important. I mean, it feels that, like, this is not to be a precious experience anymore. It's supposed to be for everybody. It's supposed to be to whoever is interested in art in Sullivan County.
Yeah.
I mean, for us, it's, you know, for the college itself, we want the county and we want the area to see us as a place that gathers people together for cultural events, for specific events, because we're the only institution of higher education in the region. So we have this beautiful theater, we have these facilities, and we want to open them up to the community and bring people in, because we are where the community can gather, can learn, and be inspired by the culture we're bringing here with the opera and with everything else we're doing at SUNY Sullivan.
And what are some other events you have coming up that folks should be aware of? You mentioned, I think, your newly revisioned spring event.
Right. So the Kite Day celebration that people remember that we've been doing for over 30 years at SUNY Sullivan has been reimagined. It's now being called Kites College Community SUNY Sullivan Spring Fest. It'll be a Saturday, May the 3rd. We're already looking for craft vendors and food vendors for it, sponsors as well. Also go to the website to learn more, and we'll have more information about it. We've really reimagined it. We're making it a college-wide event and getting people very excited about all the college has to offer people when they come here. Also, the opera series obviously continues after Fidelio on April 26th, we're going to do The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart. On May 17th, a new staging of Salome by Strauss, that they're going to do a film noir theme on that. So it looks like all the makeup and all of the art direction is in full black and white, staging Salome as a femme fatale. And then finally, Rossini's Barber of Seville for all of you Bugs Bunny fans out there.
Let's remind folks again where they can get more information about all of the Met and HD performances, including Fidelio coming up on Saturday.
So sunysullivan.edu, you'll see the Met Opera button there. You'll be able to get tickets there. You'll see the full schedule and also learn more about the operas themselves.
Right. Jamie, before we go, are we going to get a note out of you at all, or is that too much to ask?
Well, I have a note of thanks for our sponsors.
Okay, well, good transition. You deserve it.
Absolutely want to thank the Steam Fund of CFOS for their sponsorship, Jeff Bank, an anonymous sponsor, and also Neversink General Store has graciously, for the intermissions, provided coffee and snacks for us so that people can be sustained through the three-hour-plus performances.
All right, Dan Rigney from SUNY Sullivan and Jamie Hargrove from SUNY Sullivan Foundation's board and a former opera singer who's resting his voice this morning. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you,
Tim.
Thank
you.
All right, that'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, you can hear this program and all of our local programs on our website. Just go to the shows tab there on the navigation bar, click on local shows, and you can hear those there. You can also sign up for our newsletter, which is in your inbox every Friday. If you haven't been receiving it and want to get it tomorrow morning, go to wjffradio.org. Keep up on all of the events and information that are happening here. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
On Catskill Character this week, my guest is Casey Zier from Bethel, New York. She owns and is the baker at Be Kind Bakehouse in Honesdale, Pennsylvania. Join us and discover the baked goods made from scratch with no preservatives, corn syrup, or dye. Plus, she uses florals like lavender, rose water, and there's even a pine needle shortbread. How much more Catskills can you get? Find out Saturday at 10:30 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, sunny to partly cloudy skies, high 48, winds up to around 15 miles an hour. Winds light and variable tonight under cloudy skies with a low of 28. Tomorrow, generally sunny, a high 57, a little bit warmer. And so looking ahead to the weekend, we'll warm up a little bit more, but it looks like there's also a chance of rain. Saturday's high 55, Sunday 61, with rain of about an inch predicted. On Point is coming up next. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from
the Narrowsburg Union, and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.